I come in the power of life. I come in the light of wisdom. I come in the mercy of life. The light hath healing in its wings.
Welcome to the Golden Dawn Podcast. Join us now as we enter the pathway of light.
Welcome to our show this afternoon. This is your host, Robert Zink, and we are live on Blog Talk Radio, talking about the Golden Dawn, the official Golden Dawn podcast, here live on Blog Talk Radio. And for more information on the Golden Dawn, you can log on to the internet at www.esotericgoldendawn.com. Or you can visit the research site at www.golden-dawn.org. I want to remind you that coming up in Los Angeles on March 28th and 29th, we will be in Los Angeles and we're going to be doing the Attraction Alchemy Workshop called The Guarantee. It's an outrageous weekend. It's a phenomenal weekend that's based on alchemy. I believe that the teachings of Hermes were so important that they were guaranteed. So with that in mind, I hope you will come down to the Guarantee Attraction Alchemy Workshop and join us. And I know that you will receive a lot of good information, life-changing information. As a matter of fact, it's the only workshop I know of that is absolutely guaranteed. If you're not satisfied within 30 days of the workshop, we will refund your money. Okay, it's called The Guarantee, www.theguarantee.info. Today our show is focused on the Kabbalah and the Golden Dawn, and mostly about empowerment with the Kabbalah. See, the Kabbalah isn't just some dry, stale information. It's some valuable information that can radically change your life. And so what I would recommend that you do is, of course, first and foremost, stay tuned for this show. Stay with us. If you have questions, you're welcome to get on the chat room and join us in the chat room. There are some other good books that we'll recommend, but our guest today has some valuable information on the Kabbalah and how they got started and how you can make some phenomenal spiritual gains with the Kabbalah, and you can learn to do some incredible things from healing to self-enlightenment using the Kabbalah. From Los Angeles, I have V.H. Frater, TDL, joining us. Can you hear me?
Hi, Robert. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good. And I hope you're doing good down there. You have some good hot weather today?
It's pretty good weather out here so far. Got a little mixture of different kinds of hot and cold. That's probably the best so far.
Right. And let's see, we have all the way from Zurich, Switzerland. We're going to bring him on, V.H. Frater S.I. from the Temple of LLL. So we have two people clear across the world, Frater S.I. from the Temple of Zurich and Frater T.D.L. from the Temple of Isis, both a part of the Golden Dawn, but both also well-taught, well-schooled, and well-thought-out Kabbalists at the same time. So, Frater S.I., how are you today?
Good. How are you? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Fantastic.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, I think we're going to have a good conversation today in regards to the Kabbalah and the Golden Dawn. But I think the first question that always comes to mind is, how did you get started with the Kabbalah? So, Frater S.I., I think I'll throw the ball into your court since you're all the way across the world and it's around midnight your time. Why don't you share with us how you first approached the Kabbalah and what were your first thoughts when you were introduced to the Kabbalah?
Oh, wow. The first run-in I had with Kabbalah was, I suppose, one of the derivatives from the Golden Dawn, the historical Golden Dawn. And that was in a book that I think I know a lot of people have seen, and it's the Modern Magic book by Donald Michael Craig. And what he possessed there is a really simplified version of the Kabbalah, but he I was really young at the time, and he really hit a nerve with me, with the way he talks about being a Gold Dawn magician, or the way he talks about being a Kabbalist. And the system for me really struck a chord in that it's really analytical, but it's also very transcendental in that it attempts to map out the spiritual universe that exists between our material world and, well, God. I don't know. I just got lost in the system. I never found my way out. I'm still here.
Wonderful. And the nice thing about the Kabbalah is that there is a never ending. It's not like some systems where you kind of go and then you go, what's next? And you go, there's nothing next. With the Kabbalah, you're always just beginning. I mean, there's just a whole world ahead of you to explore. Frater TDL, how did you get started in the Kabbalah? What kind of attracted you to it to begin with?
Well, I can make a long story short. I was never interested in Kabbalah, let alone what the word meant. It never attracted me. I would go into occult bookstores or into your general bookstore, and I would go into the occult section and the metaphysical section, and I'd always look on something about magic or something about spirituality. So one day I came into a book called A Kabbalah for the Modern World. It was by Mien Gonzalez Whitler. And I had a few hours, so I sat down, I opened up the book, and I read the first chapter about it. And what really caught my eye, being my background, having a Christian background, it talked about Genesis, talked about the formation of Adam and Eve, it talked about the Garden of Eden. So from that point on, I couldn't put the book down, so I could kept on reading. And then there was reference to the Tree of Life and its mysteries and more things that were written about the Tree of Life than what you just see in our today's Bible in Genesis. So I continued reading and I started to realize that Kabbalah was the key that helped to unravel a lot of the mysteries, no matter what religion, no matter what belief that you're in. One of the things that was very difficult for me was to see the difference and the association between the Virgin Mary, or the Holy Mother, and Isis, the Shekinah. And when I was reading more about the Kabbalah in different books, especially in this particular one, I started to realize that the association was a correspondence, that they related, they were akin to each other, but they were named differently. You know, call it a rose, it's still a rose no matter what you call it, no matter what nationality or language you speak. So what Kabbalah did for me from that point on is that it made me curious, that I was hungry for more. I started to go out and search for different books. I mean, there's a whole list of them I could just go through, but I went through these and I started to discover more and more about my own religion and the relation that I needed to know in magic, because frankly, I wanted to do planetary magic. I wanted to do angelic magic. I wanted to do some sort of invocation of light spirits and such things. And then I really couldn't have done it had it not have been for the introduction of Kabbalah. That's where the whole idea of the Tree of Life being this glyph with all these many colors known as the Sephira on the tree, the paths on the Tree of Life, and each of them associated with a different world. And later on in studying psychology, they related to the four worlds and also to the ego and to the lower self, or the child, as we say in the Freudian series, and the child self, the adult self, and the parent self. So it really turned on to me a whole new avenue of looking at life and spirituality. And what Kabbalah did for me is that it opened up those doors for me. So now I can look and realize that my own religion, being a Christian, has no conflict whatsoever when it comes to other people's religions all across the world. That's what made me stumble across Kabbalah, let alone it opened up a whole new world for me.
So, Father, would you say that Kabbalah is a wonderful synergizer between philosophies and world beliefs, because they're all expressed on the tree? So whether you're pagan, or whether you're Jewish or Christian or whatever your background is, you can find how your philosophy or religious beliefs synergize through the Tree of Life and the Kabbalah. Does that make sense or not?
Absolutely. I think it's not just a synergizer, but I think it was a must for anyone who's really seeking for true spirituality in the depth of their own religion or their own beliefs, because that really opened up a whole new paradigm of archetypes, and not just realizing gods for what they are as a statue or a history in a book, but they're archetypes, and realizing that they're also symbols in our minds, and that there is a relationship between humankind and the divine. So I think it is a synergizing tool, but it also, it's a must if those true seekers of the light are ever going to find the true answers of their existence.
Well, in addition to that, Fetter Esai, as a synergizer or as a way of combining all of these concepts so that you're not in conflict with each other. So we're talking about a spiritual uplifting, not necessarily a religious uplifting, but not excluding a religious experience. I guess my question or my thought is there a difference between, because if you were to go to the textbook and just type in the word Kabbalah, it would say, well, you know, ancient Jewish mysticism, so forth. But is there a difference between the quote-unquote religious or kosher Kabbalah and the Western Kabbalah or the esoteric Kabbalah? And how do you see these differences working for people, empowering them?
Well, I guess that depends on what you mean by religious Kabbalah and Western Kabbalah. Let me add to what TDL just said, and that I think it's fascinating to hear how Father TDL came to the Kabbalah from a Christian background and was able to make sense of the things that he was brought up with from a Kabbalistic point of view, using the tools of the Kabbalah to unlock those things and go deeper into them, and then later to use those same tools and apply them in a magical framework. For me, and I know for a lot of other people, the Kabbalah has done the same path, but in the opposite direction, in that I, and I know a lot of other people who get into the Kabbalah don't have a religious background from my home or from my culture, really. We live in a time where religion is not so prevalent, where, you know, a belief in a theistic God is just dropping every year, and the Kabbalah provides this entry into a religious, or, well, let me say a worldview where you can marry a religious worldview with a sort of analytical worldview and also a very personal and experimental worldview. And that's where I think the Kabbalah can really serve a great purpose today in bringing people to, if not become religious, then at least reconcile with the religion and see what are our common goals. Now, to get to your question, the difference between a religious Kabbalah and a Western Kabbalah, well, I think if you were to go and look at the Kabbalah that is practiced in Israel today and taught in the schools of you know, Queen Heights in the Bronx or anywhere of these Jewish schools, the Hasidic schools, and compare those to what we teach in the Western mysteries, there will be numerous differences. Mostly because I think although we have a common root, we've really branched off into very different directions. But again, the Hebrew Kabbalah is really divided against itself as well, with a lot of different rabbis competing and interpreting the scriptures in different ways. I think the real difference in the Western mysteries is just how deeply ingrained in Greek thought it is, and also later in Christian thinking, starting all the way back with Knorr von Rosenwald and his publications in the Middle Ages.
Okay, so both of you, we're just sitting around. We are students of the Kabbalah. We're talking. But first, before we begin, because there's people out there that are going to listen to this broadcast or are listening, and I guess the question that's going through the back of their head is, okay, I'm hearing all this. This becomes a system that I can use. It's a never-expanding system. It's always expanding, I should say, system. But what exactly is Kabbalah? And I know that there's several different types of Kabbalah, but from a Western mystical perspective, what exactly is Kabbalah, and why is it?
I'd like to answer that. First of all, you need to know what the four parts of Kabbalah are. Since it's so broad, there is the practical, there are the literal, the unwritten, and then there's the dogmatic. And the literal and the dogmatic usually deals with some form of religion that deals stems from a Jewish point of view. And the practical and the unwritten deals with more the mystical aspect and the spiritual aspect. So to define what Kabbalah is, we could say it's religion to some, and to others we could say it is the key of all keys to all spirituality and higher advanced learning, and to self-discovery of the purpose of the relationship between man and the divine, the organization of the cosmos, of the universe, and also the purpose of deity and its role in life itself. It's put very simply in a nutshell.
I guess my next question that kind of stems off from that is, in the Western mysteries, where is the emphasis put for the most part? Or is it spread evenly?
Definitely in the unwritten and in the practical sense, if I may define that a little bit. The practical part of the Kabbalah deals with mostly the invocations of spirits, mostly we're talking about angels, we're talking in the creations of magical tools, particularly those in using the divine names and understanding the certain names of God in different worlds, or as we call the Tree of Life, the Sephira, and invoking them and utilizing those energies, let's just put it that way for the lack of better words, in one's life to cause change in conformance to the magician's will. So that, along with the unwritten Kabbalah, has a lot to do with same kind of aspect on the mystical, deals with more internal investigation or re-landscaping, going deeper into oneself and elevating through methods known as pathworking and scrying and traveling in the spirit vision. It's nothing new today. It's something that the prophets of the past have been doing, but just never been called these as the way we do in modern days. They also were able to travel in spirit vision and reach to a point in the divine and see God, the face of God, and be able to have conversations with them. So in the Western mysteries, lo and behold, we have today what we know with the Kabbalah that's helping us to establish that kind of connection. That's what we call the unification with the higher self or the divine genius. All in all, the Western mysteries does deal mostly with the practical and the unwritten Kabbalah, which is primarily some of these examples that I just said.
Yeah, I understand that. I think the impression that I get from the more Jewish, esoteric, Kabbalistic schools out there is that they really focus a lot on the literal Kabbalah, which is about discovering the hidden meaning of names and of words and passages in the Old Testament. And also on the dogmatic Kabbalah, about how to live, how to behave as a human being, as a spiritual person. And neither of those two have a very strong footing in the Western system, which really do deal mostly with how to make things happen, just like Rabbi TDL just said.
All the time we've been omitting the word magic in this case, and that in itself I think needs to be defined for our listeners, especially those people who are in Kabbalah. You cannot have the unwritten nor the practical parts of Kabbalah without having to include that word, magic.
Okay, so now that brings us to a whole new question that I think people want to ask, because some people that are going to listen to this show are saying, well, I'm interested in the Kabbalah. I don't know if I'm interested in this magic stuff. What are we really talking about? I mean, let's define that a little bit for people.
That's right. Would you like to start on this?
Well, the only thing that comes to mind is the definition of magic that I actually happen to disagree with. And that's the one that our good old nemesis Aleister Crowley came up with, and that is that magic is the aim of religion but the method of science. I disagree on both points, but I guess it's a good starting point for a definition.
Okay, I'd like to add that magic is a misnomer for the way that people have been looking and viewing it for these past several decades. Because when you say the word magic, people think of ceremonies, they think of evil, they think of witchcraft, they think of Wicca, they think of earth religions, they think of a lot of hocus pocus and could be some things in voodoo or some other things. You know, that's not to belittle that they don't have magic, it's simply that magic that was taught back in the old ages, centuries past, was considered sacred. It was a sacred magic because back in the olds, even the philosophers back in then who were also mages, understood the connection between the divine and man. And in so doing, in achieving this, they were able to perform these magical performances, magical operations, which basically meant that it was all in conformity with God's will. Call this the magic of the Magi. You know, we talked about the three Magi as in the Christmas story with the three wise men coming to visit the baby in the manger. Well, it's much in the same way. Their practice of magic was the science and art of understanding the universe, the cosmos, the relationship of themselves and God, and the understanding of what God's will on earth is, supposedly. And in this, you need to understand these great mysteries, which then comes up to the word magic, which is having to perform the will of the higher. There is no greater magic, I believe, for mankind than to become one with his higher self. That is the ultimate magic. And who wouldn't want that? We call that in the Golden Dawn system the summum bonum, the true stone of the wise, or it's known as the red stone to the alchemist. And so, much in the same way, when we're talking about magic, it's the unification of oneself with that divine self. And along comes with the powers of having to create changes in one's environment, in one's life, all for the betterment of that human being.
I think it's the Kabbalah also is about certainly it's about empowerment, but it's also about man's, and I say man in general, mankind as individuals, our search for meaning and our search for why we're here, our greater purpose. As we said on this show before, you know, the majority of the world works at building their life from the bottom up, and the person, the Kabbalist, looks at invoking their life or creating their life from the top down. Now, for people who are nervous or frightened by this whole idea of ritual, Kabbalah is not always just about ritual. It's about study. It's about meditation. And I think that, you know, over the years I've come up with 100 different definitions of magic, but one that seems to work for me is that it's about understanding and connecting with the divine nature within us and then creating a world that we are compelled to create and attracting a world that we're compelled to create, not based necessarily just on our own egos, but based on our connection with our divine genius or holy guardian angel, which brings us to our next question. Everybody is interested in angels. And yet most people will pick up a book, and it'll be an angel book, an angel meditation book, and there'll be something cute written there, and it'll be with Michael or Gabriel or Raphael. In the Kabbalah, better SI, there are a myriad of angels. How does the Kabbalah give us access to these angels? What's the philosophy behind this, and how can this be used to empower even the person who is not on the, say, ceremonial magic path, but still wants to empower their life?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, just like previous speakers have said, magic and Kabbalah really are about, just what you have said, reaching up into the higher and finding your own divine experience and your own higher self, right? And so you have this very transcendental aspect of the Kabbalah and of this Western magic. But in this lateral bandwidth that you have between us down here, seemingly material, and God all the way over there, seemingly completely immaterial, there are multiple strata or layers of existence that the Kabbalah really helps us to map out and give us a framework for. And what the Kabbalah does so nicely is that it attempts to place all of these different angels of the traditions into a sort of category or hierarchy. We have, like you mentioned, the archangels. And the archangels operate on a very high level, kind of far removed from what goes on here on Earth. They, in turn, have numerous legions of angels working for them. And those angels have subdivisions, and those subdivisions have even further divisions and so forth. So the Kabbalah helps us to get the sort of calling order to find the right angel for the right job.
Now, in the Kabbalah, Father TDL, there are four worlds. Can you briefly, and I know people spend years studying the four worlds, but can you briefly, for our listeners, help us understand what each one of these worlds are, starting with the top, kind of working down?
Absolutely. Well, I like to use the metaphor of how material, anything on the material, has its counterpart on the spiritual. So, much like man, who is the most complex of matter itself, we're not physically, we're not our physical bodies, we are a spiritual body inside a physical self. So you might want to say that the four worlds are laid out much in the same way as there are four different levels of existences. So if you want to look at it from the very beginning, let's quote something from Genesis. In the beginning when God said such and such, blank, 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 that beginning could be considered absolute. In other words, what was God, what was with God, what became from God. So that would be considered not even comprehensive to the mind of man. We can't even conceive of it. It's still in that world, that realm of existence. It's still considered deity. When it comes into realization and it becomes a preconceived thought, before it even becomes an action, before it even becomes an operation in the imagination, in that existing world, we call that Bria. That's the world of creation. And finally, when it comes a little bit more into tangible existence, when everything seems to be falling into play, much like an architect would design something in his head for a building or a construction site, he's forming the plans of how he's going to lay that down onto blueprints. It's a lot more realized. It's known as the world of formation. And in this world of formation, it hasn't been put onto physical paper, parchment, or even on the computer yet, but it is a world of existence. It's another level of existence, and that's known as Yetzirah. And finally, when you put it into action, all of these combine together, and it comes into its final manifestation phase. Everything is put onto blueprints, everything is put onto a scroll, everything is put onto parchment or paper. That's the final phase known as the world of expression or the world of action. That's known as the world of Asaya. So in order, from the top down to the bottom, we have the world of absolute, which is also known as the world of archetypes. We have the world of Bria, which is the world of creation. We have the world of Yetzirah, which is known as formation. And we have the final, which is the world of Asaya, or they pronounce it Asiya in some. It's known as the world of action or manifestation. To get a better gist of this, let me just mention that the world of Yetzirah is also known as the astral plane. We dream and we think on the astral. So when we go to sleep at night, and you've gotten those times when you have intense dreams and your muscles will tend to twitch, or you wake up from an intense dream that's very filled with a lot of emotion, tears start coming down your eyes. Well, your mind is acting in a different world, parallel to our own physical reality, and something's happening, and it's just as real as the world that we live in right now, but where is it? So the Kabbalah defines that as the world of Yetzirah, and it just happens to be the astral plane. It just happens to be that it's minus your own ego, your waking consciousness, that you're able to go into this world and exist on that for a period of time while you're in sleep. But even
I think it's important, if I may interrupt, because we have a wonderful chat going on in the chat room, by the way. If people are not in it, they should. I would say that they're asking, is each world a dimension? My answer would be that the Kabbalists describe this as a world. It's beyond dimension, okay? And there are dimensions within the worlds. Does that make sense, Federici, or not?
Yeah, absolutely. And inside each world, there are countless and countless of other worlds. But that when we look at these spiritual dimensions, they're not dimensions of right and left, up and down, front and back, like we see here. Those dimensions only exist in the world of Asaya, the physical plane, the world of action, whereas all the angels and the spirits are said to exist in spiritual realms. They're, for example, rather than being aligned along an axis of up versus down, they might be aligned along an axis of good and evil, or ranked as to their level of agreement with God's will or alignment with God's will. So an angel might be very high in that scale, and a demon might be very low on it. Another axis might be one of severity and mercy, and that would translate to your right and left sides, for example. So we have to think of these dimensions as dimensions of essence and of qualities rather than dimensions of space. So I think that was what the question was about.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So when we're talking about the four worlds, we're talking about absolute being actually the most simplest of worlds, but beyond, so simple it's beyond comprehension. But it's still a part of the created world. Okay, we haven't even gotten into negative existence, nor do I think we will in the show. But it's a part of the created world. It's where the mind of deity is. But as we connect to the mind of deity through some of the exercises, meditations, and prayers and invocations, as we begin to connect to this mind of deity, then we move into the world of archangels, which is in Bria, and these archangels have massive power. Now, it's interesting how Kabbalists will oftentimes debate where they belong on the tree of life. You'll hear these debates. Well, Michael belongs here, and Gabriel belongs here, and so forth. And certainly they have a kinship to a certain Sephira on the tree of life. But in fact, these archangels are so vast, so mighty. They are literally God just kind of emanating out of itself. They are spirit, divine spirit, divine source emanating out, and it's that emanation that provides the archangels. We emanate a little bit further, we end up with angels, the world of angels. And we have a countless number of angels, but we have certain ones that are very, very important that do specific things. And then, of course, our world is very complex. It's the world of matter. It's the world of man. It's the world where we exist, at least physically, at least part of us exists in this world. Would it be fair to say or unfair to say that we also exist in all four worlds at the same time? Either one. Take it.
Absolutely. We all coexist with our Creator. And I think that's where the Kabbalah discusses about the purpose of man's relationship with his Creator, which is God, which is the deity. And if we didn't coexist, it'd be basically God as an absolute, and man and humankind is down there in Asiya. There's really no connection there, and there's really no point in having to become one with your higher self. In that case, absolutely. There is the existence of man in all four different worlds, and that's all a total subject into it. We can get pretty deep on the mystical side of it. I don't think there's a simple answer to that other than what I just gave.
Well, so then the higher genius or the holy guardian angel, that would exist in what world do you think? Rather, is
your higher genius?
Yeah.
Your higher self would exist?
Yes, your holy guardian angel, your higher self, the part of God that exists within you.
That would exist in absolute. And now, because we did talk about mankind existing in all four worlds, there is that relation, there is that coexistence of you as a human being in all four worlds at the same time. But can any one person truly say that I'm now coexisting right now with my higher divine self, and truly prove that, I mean, would be another Gandhi, would be another Mother Teresa, might be another, who knows, there's several different people who's done
another
this.
Jesus, another Buddha, whatever, avatar.
Okay,
so I guess my next question as we progress along with angels, because people are intensely interested in angels. There's a difference in the way the Kabbalists will approach connecting with angels to bring about change in the material plane. In other words, I want to bring about some change in my life. What is the difference, S.I., between, say, how the Christian might, if they do at all, connect with angels for, say, healing or for finding a new job or any of the things that we have to put up with in the physical plane that we have to have as part of our life? What would be the difference between, say, how a Christian would approach that, or even a non-Christian who works with angels, and a Kabbalist? There is a difference, isn't there?
Well, I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer that on behalf of anybody who isn't me, if that makes sense, because I consider myself a Christian Kabbalist, and I do sometimes heal. So the way I would approach it is, when invoking these forces, these angels, to show them my heartfelt conviction that I'm on their side, and that we have both seen or realized the same face of God as was manifest in Jesus of Nazareth 2,000 years ago. And I don't know how a non-Christian might approach that. I suspect in a similar way of showing them their version of the highest good and showing their allegiance to the light or to God in that way. But for me, in my personal experience, it works really well to invoke the name of Christ when working with angels. They really seem to respond and to bow down in worship together with the operator. Does that make sense?
Let me take that a step further. Is that because that is your archetypal paradigm?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
I know, yeah.
It is a tough question.
I don't have to ask that question. Here's what I'm getting at, okay? I don't know where we want to go with this, but here's where I'm getting at, is that most people who are not hermeticists and Kabbalists or have not practiced invocational or practical magic, practical work is taught in the Golden Dawn. Most people would approach an angel, say Gabriel. Say they needed a healing. They might approach Gabriel because they feel a kinship. And they might ask Gabriel for Gabriel's help. And if they were Catholic, they might refer to Gabriel as Saint Gabriel. And they might do a litany of prayers of some sort. Okay? Essentially, asking for the angel's intercession with God. Act as my intercessor. Much like saints, act as my intercessor with God, the divine source, whatever you wish to call it. Okay? The Kabbalist, now that's almost starting from the bottom and working up. Okay? And that's how I see most people in the exoteric world practicing their work with angels. The Kabbalist and the magician tend to start from the top down. And Father TDL, can you carry on with this a little bit? Don't they start with absolute and then through that, what Feder S.I. talked about earlier, they're talking about the kind of the hierarchy, because they are connecting by intention and by will and by rights, they are connecting to their higher genius as much as they possibly can. They now have a kind of blood right. Oh, did I say that word? Yeah, I did. They have a blood right. They have a sangriel, if you will, a connection with the divine source in that they are one and the same, that the divine source works through them, they work through the divine source, okay? And so then they are able to call upon or invoke these angels rather than merely ask for their help or intervention. What is the difference between asking for the help of an angel and invoking an angel.
Oh, you're asking me. Now, is this in reference to whether you be a Christian, whether you be a Jew?
It doesn't make any difference. I mean, yeah, it doesn't make any difference because my experience is that most people, and I can't speak for everybody, but most people go directly to the angel and ask for some intervention or help. What we as Kabbalists learn to do is we learn to go to our higher and divine self, and which is God within. It is the microcosm or the macrocosm. And therefore, we have a type of authority to call upon these angels for aid. I use the word authority, okay? That's a key word there. That's the difference.
Right. There's a couple different things you asked, and I'm not too sure which way to attack this, but I can say this, the authority part of it is that regardless if you are aware of Christian Bible, and regardless if you are Jewish practicing Kabbalah, and perhaps you are paganistic in your beliefs, or perhaps you have no religion whatsoever, regardless of all of that, it does not push aside the fact that there is the spark of God within each and every human being on this planet. And because that's so, that also gives mankind the right over all things created, whether it be the firmament or the ether, upon the earth or under the earth, on dry land, in the water, of warm air or rushing fire, and everything that is created under this, under the hand of God, because as we talked about in the Emerald Tablet, as above, so below, but even further, He is part of me. There's no part. He is in me, and I am in Him. There's no part of me that's not of God, says the esoteric tradition as taught. So,
by the way, that was one of MacGregor Mather's favorite sayings. There's no part of me not of the God, and I think that indicates that if we learn the techniques and the methods of elevating ourselves to that divine aspect within, then we have the ability to call on these angels and say, I am invoking you now. Okay. And then working down that hierarchy, we may get down to a very specific or narrow angel, a very small angel, but that angel's the right angel. We're not taking a hatchet to the job, we're taking a scalpel to the job. And in the Kabbalah, we have what? We have millions of angels. We have thousands of them recorded that we can use, but we have unlimited numbers that we can call upon, right?
Right, absolutely. But that being said, also shows that there is a reflection of the totality of the universe, all in a microscopic form, known as man, known as mankind, known as the microcosm. So, in that sense, there's no other created living creature on this earth that has that same kind of reflection with the divine other than human beings. So, much in the same way, mankind, whether or not he's aware of it, of his higher self, still has the power and authority over angels. It's the question of when that person chooses to take that seat on that throne to have that power and dominion over his life and over everything that's governing over his life, mainly the hierarchy of how life works. We're talking about angels, we're talking about archangels, we're talking about spirits and all such like.
We have somebody else joining us for a moment. Are you with us?
Me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I was calling in to listen because I kept losing my connection on my internet, but I would love to join in the conversation. So.
Okay. Okay. Well, what's your thought so far? Do you have a thought, or, I mean, you've been following?
I was asking about the dimensions on there, under the title Jaron on there. One of my questions with the Kabbalah is, does it take sound frequencies and octaves into consideration as well, as in, say, the Hindu tradition where they would say in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, and that word would be Om, that first word that spoke light into existence. And then from there, everything carries a tone and a frequency. Does the Kabbalah take that into consideration, something of that nature?
I'd like to answer that question, if I may.
Sure, go ahead.
Ab- absolutely. Let me sum it in this way. When people think of an angel, or they hear the word or name of an angel, they're thinking of a name that has letters and so forth, but they don't think of it as an energy or a vibration. See, in their world, when an angel speaks, it's at a melodious pitch. And what that melodious pitch and key tone is, only the Kabbalah can answer that. So we can actually look it up and find out what that key pitch is. The name Mikael, for example, he vibrates at a certain key level pitch. You know, it's said in the Nothings of the angelic language that they speak at a certain tone, a certain melodic tone. So if you want to consider that certain forces, certain energies are levels of vibration, just like colors are forces, are vibrations. We can also associate them to as musical tones and notes as well.
Well, certainly, just to add to that, we know through, of course, the study of quantum science that there really is no material plane. That is illusionary. And, of course, mystics and Kabbalists have been teaching us that for thousands of years, but it took science to pull out the microscope and come up with that concept. We're just all energy. It's just all energy. And in fact, the energy all vibrates at different levels and different frequencies. But in fact, we're even more space than we are matter. We're only less than 1% matter. We're virtually nothing more than energy vibrating. So everything we try to do tries in the Kabbalah and in the Golden Dawn, at some level, is trying to focus itself on vibration and connecting with the right vibration, not only through sound, but primarily through color as well, and through scent, through all of, or in other words, we're awakening all of these different aspects or submodalities of processing information. Would you say, Frater Asai, that I covered that? Okay, is there anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, definitely. I would say, right, that we talked earlier about how the Kabbalah tells us that we exist on all these different planes at the same time. The question is just, am I at this present moment integrated with my higher genius, with my neshama? That's the question. Am I or am I not? If I were, I would probably be a Buddha or a Jesus or, you know, a Muhammad or something else. And I think in the Kabbalah we have a sort of similar story as we have in so many other religious movements and theological systems, a story of a paradise lost. And that paradise is symbolized by this union with God. And we've said earlier that the path of the magician is to unionize or to unify with that divine aspect of yourself. The problem is, however, is that we've forgotten how to do that. We've forgotten the language that God speaks on that level, or that we speak with God on that level. And we have to relearn it. And we use colors and sounds and tastes and scents and symbols and names on this plane to help relearn that language and rediscover those realms within ourselves and within the universe at large to be able to build a bridge back into that lost paradise. So that's where I think vibration and colors and music and all those things all fit into this great, fantastic system that has been fleshed out over thousands of years to help us accomplish that journey.
Now, how does that relate to the Tree of Life? Maybe if you, as you're relating that, because it seems like the Tree of Life then gives you kind of a road map, or at least it's kind of like when you're on a long road trip, you kind of know where you're at by the scenery. The Tree of Life kind of gives you that option of knowing where you're at in your progression, so that you're not just out there or in there, but you know where you need to go next. You know how to direct yourself next. So perhaps we could just kind of briefly go through the Tree of Life. People have seen it. It's those 10 circles and the 22 paths. You want to go through those real quickly for us?
No, absolutely. There are 10 spheres of manifestation. They're known as sephirot, sephiras for singular, working from the top down to the bottom. The first is Keter. The second is Hokmah. The third is Bina. the fourth is Chesed, the fifth is Geburah, the sixth is Tiferet, the seventh is Netzach, the eighth is Hod, the ninth is Yesod, and the tenth is Malkut. And there's several different correspondences that relate to all of these. Basically, it's the world of manifestation to all different parts of our being. And then there are the connecting paths all in between them, which are the 22 paths also related to the 22 major arcana of the tarot deck. It goes from the top to the bottom, so the Fool and the Magician on either side of the Tree of Life connecting with Keter. And when you go to the very bottom, which is closest to Malkut, which is closest to the bottom, that would be ending in the Universe card, which is the 32nd path. That's the Tree of Life, but I wanted to just throw in the, on your, are you still there with the question about the tones?
Sure. He's listening.
Okay, I just wanted to just say this, that even on the Tree of Life, as there are colors and there are forces, they also have melodic tones also. When you think of, for example, purple, deep purple, it's a very, very low vibrating tone, as opposed to something like reddish-orange. It's a very high pitched tone. And finding those exact keys, there is a correspondence list in our esoteric Kabbalah that you can find and locate and be able to link your mind, your consciousness, and transfer it into that particular world. So, for example, if you're going to be working in the world of Yesod, which is the superior Yesod, that is violet in color, purple in color. And you have to use that particular tone for that, and you can achieve that. We use divine names. As Kabbalists, we use divine names because that divine name is that perfect tone, which would help us to elevate to that level of consciousness. Okay, so just a summary, that's the Tree of Life. Those are the 10 Sephiroth. What connects them are the 22 paths, which are relating to the tarot deck, the major arcana, and the whole entire Sephiroth is a reflection of the microcosm, or the human being, mankind himself. It's also a glyph of the entire universe as a whole. And it also is, there are also different glyphs, there are also different dimensions or parts of the Tree of Life where we can say exists the archangels and the choirs of angels and the lesser angels and the lesser spirits below them, etc., etc.
So all of these energies are now available to the practitioner of the Kabbalah. Let me ask you this question, Frater Esai. Now, we've talked about the Tree of Life as best we could, and it really is a visual thing that we should, you can see plenty of examples of it if people want to go to golden-dawn.org. I think there's some examples of the Tree of Life if they haven't seen it before. But now, as that Tree of Life is used as a roadmap, both an internal roadmap and as divine emanations, through the paths and the Sephiroth, how does that apply to the process of initiation to the Golden Dawn? Hey, Religia, I think we might have lost him. Let's see if we got him on here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay. We lost him. Okay. Go right ahead.
Yeah, it just dropped out. The wonders of the internet. I think I heard the last part of the question was how does this progression relate to the initiation or the path of initiation?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have these various emanations of the divine that come in different colors and stuff like that, and then we have these internal paths or these internal progressions and vibratory states upward that connect to these emanations that are called the paths in the Tree of Life. But somehow, the Golden Dawn, we've managed to integrate all that into the process of initiation. What's that all about?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, the more I learn...
Your 30-second elevator speech on that.
The more I learn about this thing, the more I realize I don't know how it works, but that it does work. I can attack it from an analytical and symbolic level, and if I were to try and do that, I would say that the world in the Kabbalistic sense, the entire world, the entire Tree of Life of this 10 Sephiroth, was created in the image of the lightning flash. which is this sort of zigzag pattern that enumerates the Sephiroth from Kether at the top and Malkuth at the bottom. And that's the sort of emanation, continual emanation, kind of like we see in Genesis, where at first we have the waters, and then out of the waters comes the earth, and out of the earth comes the plants and the animals and so forth. It's kind of that way of emanating from nothingness into somethingness, if that makes sense. So that's a sort of downward movement on the tree, and that's signified by this lightning flash or flaming sword. On the other direction, going upwards from the bottom, from Malkuth, from the world we see around us now, we have the path of the serpent, and that is path with which the paths are enumerated. And that's, if the flaming sword, if this downward movement is a creative movement, then the path back towards that source is not so much a creative movement as it is a redemptive movement, and it is the path that we take on our journey back. And in the Golden Dawn system, we have this concept of enumerating the grades. So the very first grade would be the very first grade on the Tree of Life would be signified by 1 and a 10 with an equal sign between them. Which, one way you can read this is to say that, okay, now you've made one step, you have 10 to go. The next grade would be 2 equals 9, when you're initiated into the ninth Sephiroth, and so forth. So in the eighth Sephiroth of Hod, you have 3 equals 8. So, in a way, we can say that we're retracing our steps, which is a forward movement and a backward movement at the same time. So one number is increasing, and another is decreasing. And so we're basically working our way from where we are now through the power of initiation and through these symbolic experiences that we have, whether it be in the temple or at home through an astral initiation. And we're making this journey back. We're unraveling what has been covering our eyes for so long. And again, it is this return to paradisical state that we're trying to accomplish.
This is really an awakening process that is a lifetime process. It's not just a weekend seminar, is it?
I've been well over 10 years now, and still not enlightened. Got a TDL that's enlightened, but I'm not.
Okay. Well, I mean, my point is that some people that have come out of the Golden Dawn community will claim a grade by saying, well, I've achieved that grade, or I've hit that grade, which simply means you've hit that state on the Tree of Life. But isn't that an all-the-time process, better TDL? I mean, it doesn't really just... There is a line of demarcation called the initiation. But then the initiation never stops, does it? I mean, the progress and the growth and the... How can you know everything there is to know, even about Malkuth?
No.
Let alone you sowed?
No, it's just a life-growing process. And the more you know, the more the less you know. It's, life is constant, and so are you. And as you grow, so does everything else around you. Your consciousness, your awareness starts to elevate and become something bigger, better, and greater. And you start to realize that you really are part of the macrocosm, and the macrocosm is really a part of you. And that always evolves and always changes and always grows. It's never stagnating, never complacent.
Now, I guess my question is this. Some people would say that you are learning and growing, and that's good for conversation. It's easy. But on a more esoteric level, are you perhaps remembering what you already know, what you lost through incarnation, but deep down in your spirit you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that question because we have a tool in our temple, in the Golden Dawn Temple, but it's much like the Caduceus of Hermes, and I like to just describe one part of it, and that is the globe, which is in the very center of the wings, represents to awake. I like this quote. It awakens the sleeper within. And the question I like to ask students is, who was sleeping to begin with? You know, why is it such an important tool? And why do we need to be awakened? Are supposedly this person or race supposed to be awakened?
And so because of that, I would say that there is something that the ancients had believed or known, that there was something latent in mankind that somehow drifted into a time of dormancy or still remaining in dormancy. We're almost like in this dream state, if you will, and from that, mankind must be able to emerge and awaken from that. And when awakened, that's what we call conscious awareness. And that's what we call enlightenment. That's what we call unification with the divine. So therefore, the words all laid out in the place of what the whole purpose of the great work is, does prove itself to repeat that it's nothing more than what we need to do is constantly awaken, constantly grow, and constantly achieve our highest potential, which is unification with our higher self or our highest purpose of what we're doing here in our life for, what, 60 to 80 years of our life here. I mean, I'd hate to see that the last day of my life, I'm going to say in my deathbed, I really don't know what my true purpose was living here on this earth. You know, if I did this and I did that, so I get a job here, I was able to meet these people, I got married, I got these kids, etc. But maybe that wasn't my true purpose. So my favorite caption was that it awakens the sleeper within. So yeah, you're constantly being initiated, you're constantly growing, constantly elevating, evolving.
Well, we're gonna have to wrap this up in a few minutes, but we're gonna give us at least 5 more minutes for each of you to bring out something that you think is important in the study of the Kabbalah as it relates to the Golden Dawn. I want to remind people that if they're interested in learning more about the Golden Dawn and initiation, they can go to www.esotericgoldendawn.com. Federer S.I., I know we've left out all kinds of stuff. I mean, we just have just lightly scratched the surface. We haven't even scratched the paint off the surface. But what are some important points that you want to bring out before we close?
Well, I'd say that for as many years as I've studied the Kabbalah, and for as many years I've beat my head against some of the more esoteric aspects of it, it never occurred to me until quite late in the game that maybe I'm being too analytical about it. Maybe I'm trying to fit a mental screw in a physical hole. Or maybe it's wrong to think of mental and physical to begin with. Maybe it's all just one. What I'm trying to say is that when you attack the Kabbalah from a literal point of view, trying to read it literally, then you make the mistake of taking like a fisherman's net and hanging it up in the air in front of you and looking at a beautiful scenery and maybe a great mountain or something and you'll be able to enumerate how many squares and how many loops the top of the mountain is from the horizon and you'll be able to see how many squares is sky and how many squares is ground and that kind of thing. And then when you're done counting all those things and you're done writing up all the correspondences and things like that, you just roll up the net and walk away and said, well, that's the mountain. I've seen it now. That's really not what it's about. It's about walking the mountain. It's about making my way up there and then having the Kabbalah in the back pocket as a way of interpreting the experiences I'm actually having rather than trying to describe experiences that you read about or that you know exist out there in the world, but you're not actually having yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, certainly. If you don't experience the Kabbalah from the inside out rather than from the outside in, you're not really receiving from the Kabbalah. I mean, you're looking at the outside of an orange, but you're not receiving the juice from the inside of the orange that's really life-giving and empowering.
Yeah, absolutely.
Better TDL, how about you?
I just have to say, Menji, that's a very good point, that we don't internalize a lot of things that we spiritualize or we read as spiritual material. I want to add on to that is, if you are endeavoring on a spiritual path, and Kabbalah just happens to be right there in front of you as one of those doors that you're opening. The question that you already have in your spirit is not necessarily the one that you're, it's not, may not actually be in front of you as you're trying to look for it. I guess what I'm trying to say is, when you're going, venturing through the Kabbalah, you need to find out what exactly you are looking for. I know in my life, briefly, what I was looking for, but I didn't know how to pose the question until I opened up a book. And when it started talking about Genesis, I knew exactly where I was going. But for those listeners out there, when you are looking for something in your life, people don't come across the Kabbalah for no reason. It means to say you have questions and that they are unanswered. Well, what is it that you need to have fulfilled in your life, therefore you're having these questions? What are those questions? So I would pose that people who are coming into such a system as spirituality as the Kabbalah, and even into the order, the Esoteric Order, the Golden Dawn, is that you're asking exactly, specifically, what you are wanting. What are you desiring? What are you looking for? You know, aspirants come to the mysteries, we say that as the first thing. What are you looking for? And that in itself answers it. So if you're looking for angels, there's tons of things about angels that you can learn on. If you want to learn something on the literal part of it, there are tons of books you can learn on that also. Lots of dogma that you can learn on that.
Well, yeah, our library is filled with books. The internet is overflowing with information. But with all the information, with all these books, we have Kabbalists who are still homeless and still don't understand how to live in the world because they're doing the work in one area, maybe in Yetzirah, in the astral plane, but they're not bringing it down into the world of action. You have to have a counterpart, which is action. And I think that's where a organized school and an organized fraternity with checks and balances and people helping you, like the Esoteric Order of the Golden Dawn, can keep you from just becoming a daydreamer, but learn to daydream to your highest potential, but also apply it in your life on a regular basis.
Right. I agree. And it's just simply asking the right questions, and you can find that specifically in the Kabbalah. You know, may I also add this, that there are people who come to such an order like this who are people who can't seem to find the answer in their own church.
That's true. Well, we're gonna have to. First off, this has been fascinating, and the chat room is buzzing and all that. But I want to both extend an invitation to continue this conversation on the Kabbalah in the near future, because maybe we can take where we've left off and go a little bit further and take one aspect of the Kabbalah and do that. So that would be wonderful. Father TDL, you're welcome to hang on. We're going to talk about the state of the Golden Dawn in Europe. If you'd like to continue with us, or if you'd like us to say goodbye, we'll say goodbye to you.
I'd like to for just a little bit while longer, if that's okay.
Okay, well, we have about 17 minutes left. Frater S.I. is... You don't like the word imperator, do you?
I have no attachment to the word.
Okay. Now... You're with the Temple LLL in Zurich. In Zurich, if people look at the map in Europe, of course they know that it's almost the center of Europe, at least Western Europe. And we've had a temple there, the Esoteric Order of the Golden Dawn, and the good members there who support that temple and work hard at the temple. It's absolutely a beautiful temple. You know, you walk in there and there's all these, they've taken the time to put in beautiful hardwood. What is it, hardwood flooring? Is that what it is? It's kind of it's not laminate, but it's a hardwood flooring, floor and leather sofas and a nice little library and everybody's friendly. That's what I like about it. And then, you know, if you get bored with the temple, you can walk down the block and there's all kinds of little shops and things like that. So it's in a nice area of town. But what's the overall feeling of mysticism and magic in the Golden Dawn in Europe right now?
Let me first say that, just to avoid any confusion on behalf of our listeners, we are the Temple of LLL, and we're in Zurich, and yes, we are continental adepts, but the word LLL, or the name LLL, is an homage to the mythical LLL temple that the Golden Dawn draws its at least its mythical lineage from, and it's an homage to the fact that there was something even before the Golden Dawn of 1888. There was a tradition that existed within Europe and within the Greco-Roman world that goes as far back as we have history. So coming back to today, I think we see now a great hunger and a great interest in what the Golden Dawn can offer. I think people were really hyped up about New Age in the 90s, and a lot of them have become dissatisfied with what the New Age could bring them and are looking for the harder questions and the harder answers. And that's where I feel that the Golden Dawn really can do a great service to the community of seekers out there. And I invite all seekers to become finders in the Golden Dawn community, be it ours or, you know, some other group out there that you find some sort of connection with. We saw many years ago, say late 90s, early 2000s, a great interest in the Eastern Bloc. Remember that, Fedor?
Sure, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, after the fall of the Iron Curtain, it was as if a great big lid had been pushed down on the entire Eastern Bloc, and now it was lifted, and all these esoteric communities were starting to grow and starting to look for what else was out there in the West. We've seen some beautiful stuff coming out of the Czech Republic, out of Prague, and out of Hungary and those places. The East is really blossoming in terms of the esoteric resources that are coming out. We see some amazing work done at the Rijksmuseum Library in Amsterdam, Holland, and some academic work that is starting to come now in the last 10 or maybe 5 years, all following in the tradition of Frances Yates and her publication of her Rosicrucian mystery books that really brought back a lot of the academia and into the world of esotericism. And I see that wherever I look in European faculties today. Did you have
another question? I want to continue on that thought. So in a sense, do you feel that the people that are in the order, in the temple there at LLL, kind of feel, because I know that we have a nice group developing in London, and it seems like we're having a group develop in Italy as well. So do you kind of feel like there is a mission and purpose behind, and especially when you mentioned Prague, of course, the kind of the capital of alchemy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and having a mystical core there seems very important too. Is there kind of a mission and purpose that people have there that, yes, this we're reawakening, you know, parts of the land that have been dead for a while?
Well, you know, you really hit home there because I feel strongly about that. I walk down the streets here and I see houses that were standing in the 13th century. For Americans, that might be even hard to fathom, but yeah, they're all here. All along the Rhine Valley, people in Zurich, where I live, like to say that the Rhine starts in Zurich. I don't know if that's true, but the river here certainly feeds into the Rhine. And the Rhine stretches all the way over into Basel and then north up into France and Germany. And this was the hot spot of the Western esoteric movement for hundreds of years. This is where you have people like Paracelsus and all these great figures. In fact, you can go and see the house which Paracelsus lived in Basel now. I've been there. It's fantastic. And you have all these amazing places, and wherever you go, you're reminded of this tradition that helped form the Reformation, that helped form the Western world and the philosophy that we now call the modern philosophy. And, you know, if we here in Zurich and Temple of LLL can help bring and revitalize some of that tradition today, wow, fantastic.
Now, there's been kind of an exodus out of the churches. It's no secret for the last, 40 years out of the churches in Europe and kind of, I don't want to say atheism, but at least a sense of, well, spirituality or religion is not important. I'm getting the sense, at least when I've been over there, that yes, people are still in that moving away from the church or that exodus from the church, but they're also now looking, they've gone through the New Age concept, and a lot of them are looking to go back into something. They're looking for something that has some meat and has some kind of self-empowerment. You want to speak
absolutely
to that? Is that what most people are looking for in Europe right now?
Well, I think, for example, in Switzerland, you have about 48% of the people here have a belief in a god. And that number is declining all the time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that atheism is on the grow, because I think what is happening is that people are redefining what God is to them, and it's moving away from what they have been taught that God is, and into something, or into a mindset where we're allowed to ask questions about God. We're allowed to ask questions about our place here. And that's something I see in a lot of people. I'm not old enough to really see a great big trend over several decades, but I definitely see a lot of people asking themselves, what else is there? What are my other options other than the major organized religions? And I think you see similar developments in America. Again, I think that's a great niche that the Golden Dawn can fill, in that we're not overly dogmatic on who God is or what God is, but we give you the framework and some of the tools of the trade to embark on that journey to go and meet Him. It's a tremendous experience. And for me, in my life, having gone through this experience of initiation and of a sort of spiritual awakening, I have gained a tremendous respect for all kinds of religious exercises and religious worldviews out there, and I see them as an expression of, in words and in symbols, of something absolutely universal that I have had the great fortune of taking part of and seeing myself, and it has redefined who I am as a person and as a human being, and I'd love for other people to have a similar experience.
Now, in the esoteric order of the Golden Dawn, there's three levels. There's a temple, which has the ability to initiate. There is a sanctuary, which usually has a portal member or an adept, but is lacking a number of other significant components, such as enough adepts to maintain a temple. But it is usually in the process of wanting or forming a temple. And then there are, of course, the study groups. And there's study groups all over the place, and some of them can be as small as 3 people, and some of them, I think we had one that was as large as about 30 at one time, or still in New York, or is it Texas someplace, they have a study group that's huge. Anyway, my point is, we have a sanctuary, which is right below the temple status, in London, and we have a wonderful individual over there, that you work with on a regular basis, we both know, and there is this belief, at least among some people, that you have to be a Mason to be a part of the Golden Dawn, that you have to go through Masonry or something similar like the Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia in order to be a part of the Golden Dawn. That really isn't true, is it?
No, but we can see where this belief came from. Historically, in the very early days of the order at the turn of the 20th century, or the beginning of the 20th century, a big recruiting ground for the historical Golden Dawn was these Masonic circles, but it was formed kind of like a reaction to Masonry. It was felt by many that this early Rosicrucian current within Freemasonry had been diluted. I'm not a Freemason, so I can't speak about that. I can't analyze the state of Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry. But from what I've heard from people who have made the step to coming into a Golden Dawn order, or in many cases our Golden Dawn order, is that they say, wow, I didn't even know this was possible. You know, here we have the difference between a ritual that is carried out by rote and by just going through the motions, and on the other hand, a ritual that is so full of life and so full of, well, for the lack of a better term, significance. And a lot of them are absolutely amazed. And you won't find that in Freemasonry today, I believe. But you don't have to be a Mason to be in the Golden Dawn. I think in many ways it hinders you to be a Mason in the Golden Dawn, because you might not see the uniqueness of the Golden Dawn for all the Freemasonic aspects. Because, let's be honest, I mean, you do have very similar symbolism in parts, seeing that Freemasonry is a forerunner to modern Golden Dawn. But you really don't have to be a Mason. You really don't. If you are a Mason, that's fantastic, you know, and please share your experiences of your differences. But you can't say that you have to be a Mason. Absolutely not. I'm looking at the chat room. Angela said that Masons don't like women, and I'm not sure that's true. I'm sure they like women, but they don't necessarily want women to be part of their ceremonies. In Golden Dawn, the tradition has it that when S.L. MacGregor Mathers was asked to help form the Golden Dawn out of a group of SRIA members, one of his explicit terms was that women be allowed in. And we certainly see in history a lot of really prominent female members. In several temples, we had female imperators, which is basically the highest rank you can have within a Golden Dawn Outer Order temple. You see some absolutely powerful and amazing women that have been and still are part of the Golden Dawn, be it in Europe or elsewhere in the world. Let me take 1 minute here to just do a shameless plug for our temple here in LL. We do an annual event called the Winter Conclave here, and we've been doing this since the very modest beginnings in the year 2000, I think. About 3-4 days when all of our members all over Europe and States as well, for that matter, are welcome to come and share with us for about 3-4 days of initiations, practical magic, and some great classes. This year we had classes on the Tarot, both practical and theoretical. We had a great class on spiritual alchemy, and another class on the origins of the pentagram, plus some great magic as well. Angela says that Conclave is awesome, she hears, and you hear right, Angela, it's absolutely true. Jaron is saying, would you say the masculine and feminine energies are merging at this time? So this has been a presentation from the Esoteric Order of the Golden Dawn, courtesy of Robert Zink and Frater TDL. I'm Frater SI. We're running out of time here. We hope you've enjoyed the show. So thank you all for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week.